Stay tuned for Bob Enyart Live. But first, hi, I'm Pastor Bob Enyart with our Denver Bible Church update. I've got my Bible open to Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 10. And there's a fascinating subject in here where Paul, as he does frequently, he contrasts law and grace. And Israel, as you know, Israel received the covenant of law from God. Actually, at Mount Sinai with Moses, Moses got the Ten Commandments, right, on two tablets of law. And they were not two tablets of grace. While there's grace that undergirds the Mosaic covenant, the Jews were under a covenant of law. And then later, as you go through the Bible, you find out that God gives to the body of Christ the covenant of grace. And I realize there are a lot of Christians who think, no, that's not true. It was always a covenant of grace, or there was only one. But the Bible really shows two covenants, a covenant of law and a covenant of grace. And God has things to teach mankind through both covenants. Well, in Romans 10, Paul is contrasting. He says, Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. If he's the end of that now, there must have been a time before that, right? And then Paul says that Moses writes about the righteousness which is of the law that says the man who does those things, speaking of doing, keeping the law, shall live by them. So the righteousness which is of the law says you have to do good works. But the righteousness of faith speaks in this way. And then Paul gives an example to compare the gospel of grace to Israel's covenant of law. He says that Christ ascended, first he descended into the abyss, and then he ascended into heaven. And Paul gives that as an example. And he's saying, can you do that? Can you go down into hell and then rise up into heaven? Can you do that? And the answer is, no, I can't do that. And his point is, Jesus Christ already did it. Therefore, the righteousness of faith speaks in this way, with the heart one believes unto righteousness. That if you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. So do you see the contrast? He says, Moses writes, this is the Ten Commandments, the Mosaic Law, the Covenant of Circumcision. In Romans 10, Paul writes, Moses writes about the righteousness which is of the law, that a man who does those things, that is, you have to do good works according to the righteousness that Moses writes about. But the righteousness of faith speaks in this way, if you believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. You see the difference? The one is, when it's of the law, it includes works. And when it's of the gospel of grace, through faith alone, then it's of faith alone. And so that's why Paul says in Romans 4, he says that the man who does not work, to that man, God justifies that man. It's an amazing verse. Romans 4, verse 5, to him who does not work. Another, he's not saying you can't have a job, you got to be unemployed. He's saying to him who has no good works, but believes in God, his faith is accounted for righteousness. Isn't that something? To him who has no works, to him who does not work, but believes. And that's very different than under the covenant of circumcision and the Mosaic law. Because under the Mosaic law, you had to keep the law. And when you failed, then there was provisions for when you failed. But you had to endure and keep the law. Whereas under the gospel of grace, you're saved by grace through faith alone. This is Bob Enyart for Denver Bible Church. Now stay tuned for Bob Enyart Live.
Service with a weekend.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, America's most popular, self-proclaimed, right-wing, religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Our phone number, 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Now, I'd like us to take an experiment. What could we call it? A lab experiment in democracy. And let's use tonight, the Democrats are debating in New Hampshire, and they're trying to get their party's nomination to campaign against George W. Bush for the presidency. And let's take somebody who's doing reasonably well in the polls in New Hampshire and the candidate who has the implicit support of the Clintons, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Wesley Clark, former General Wesley Clark. Now, he's running with the Democrats, and most of the Democrats have been radically against the war in Iraq. And Howard Dean came out aggressively against the war in Iraq, and he shot to the head of the pack. So General Clark, wanting those Democratic primary votes, is strongly against the war. But I'd like to compare, and we'll use this as an experiment in democracy to see how democracy functions. Wesley Clark stated in a debate that he has always been firmly against the current war in Iraq. Now, you may have heard of some of these quotes, but we might do them in a bit more detail. But Wesley Clark has argued for war in Iraq, said that it's the right thing to do. We should attack Iraq. And after we had been bombing Iraq and destroying its army and Baghdad fell, 3 weeks into the war, he's approving of the war. He wrote an editorial saying that it was a great thing. And so now he's campaigning, saying he's always been against the war. So let's look at some of these details. All right, in a debate in October 26th, 2003, Wesley Clark said, "I've been very consistent. I've been against this war from the beginning." And then he emphasized, "I was against it in the summer. I was against it in the fall. I was against it in the winter. And I was against it in the spring." Now, did he leave out any season there? The season of his discontent. "And I'm against it now." Okay, so he was against it. Whenever it was, he's been against it. From the moment we commenced it, he's been against it. Well, let's find out. But 6 months before that, he wrote an editorial piece that was published in the London Times. So this is October. It's in the fall when he said, "I've always been against it every season." Well, 6 months earlier, that would make it the spring. And in the spring, he wrote a letter to the editor that was published in the London Times. And he's the former leader of the NATO effort in Kosovo. And so, you know, he's a known entity. People know who he is. So he writes this letter to the editor that is published in the London Times, and he praised the courage of President Bush, praised it, and Tony Blair, who are the two fighting the war with their soldiers primarily. He wrote, quote, this is on April 10th, 2003. This is 3 weeks after the war began. Baghdad has fallen. All right, and this is what he wrote. He wrote, "President Bush should be proud of his resolve in the face of so much doubt." Now, does that sound like he's against the war? And Tony Blair. He wrote, "Can anything be more moving than the joyous throngs swarming the streets of Baghdad? Memories of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the defeat of Milosevic in Belgrade flood back. Statues and images of Saddam are smashed and defiled." So he's praising George Bush once Baghdad falls. Now, does it sound like he's against the war? He's praising him and comparing it with great moments in history. Well, back up. That's after the war started. But in the springtime, in the fall, before the war started, Congress voted on an Iraq resolution that gave the president the power to go to war. And General Clark testified before Congress 2 weeks before that resolution. And he testified that Saddam had chemical and biological weapons. He offered his testimony on September 26th of, all right, I said back up 6 months. Is that right? No, back up a year and 6 months, because this was September 26, 2002, when Congress passed that resolution. Is that timing right? I got to check that date in this article here on the Drudge Report. I'm going to check that date. But at any rate, Wes Clark testified before committee in Congress, the House Armed Services Committee, and here's what he said. He said he's arguing on the right of America to go to war against Iraq. And he said, this is simply a longstanding right of the United States and other nations to take actions they deem necessary in their self-defense. Every president has deployed force as necessary. He's done so without multilateral support, if necessary. He's done so in advance of conflict, if necessary, preemptive. In my experience, I was the commander of the European forces in NATO when we took action in Kosovo. We did not have the United Nations approval, and we did so in a way that was designed to preempt ethnic cleansing and regional destabilization. So he's arguing, Wesley Clark is arguing the entire right-wing conservative justification for the war. And now he says, I was against it. From the moment they commenced it, I've been against it. But he wasn't. He was for it. After the fall of Baghdad, he's praising Bush. Before the fall of Baghdad, well, there's more here. The United Nations, he testified to Congress, was not able to agree to support the decision with a resolution. What decision was that? That was the decision when NATO used force, right, in Kosovo to take out Milosevic. Now, did Milosevic kill? Was he responsible for as many deaths and tortures and rapes as Saddam? No, he couldn't hold a candle to Saddam. And here are the arguments, but it gets better. So we'll finish this right after this break.
At Bob Inyart Live and KGov.com, you'll find literature, audio, and video products that are a must for the library of any Christian interested in studying the truth of the Bible. You'll find essential material like the plot manuscript, an overview of the whole Bible that will clear up doctrinal issues. Then there's The Tree, a fun audio journey back to the Garden of Eden, where you'll learn about this most famous tree and its impact on humanity. Check out the Mount Moriah video. This video gives evidence for the resurrection, combining biblical and secular resources. It's a great witnessing tool. And don't forget the death penalty video. Learn that Jesus advocated the death penalty and learn how God put the death penalty at the heart of the gospel. You can directly help Bob's outreach by subscribing to Best of Bob, Bob's Best 8 Shows of the Month, or build a Bible study library by ordering the monthly Bible albums. There's a lot more, so give us a call at 1-800-8-INYARD. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278 or KGOV.com.
Bob Inyart here with a live commercial break. Hey, the plot manuscript, we haven't talked about that much in the last 6 months, but that's been at the basis of this program for how many years now? 6 years? 7 years? The plot is a 330-page manuscript, an overview of the whole Bible. And the goal in writing the plot, actually now I've been studying the Bible for 30 years, and since the plot's first release, we've been updating it, improving it with comments from thousands of readers now. And the goal of it is to give people an overview of the Bible to where they're comfortable with the story of the Bible, the major players, the books of the Bible, the covenants that are described in the Bible. How does it all fit together? And once you know the overview, the storyline, the plot of the Bible, then the details begin to take care of themselves. Because there are thousands of details in the Bible that seem confusing or even to be contradictory. Why does the Bible seem to contradict itself 1,000 times over? Christians struggle. The hard sayings of Jesus, the alleged discrepancies in the Bible. Well, the way to attack that problem is to first get the overview, and then the details will be resolved. So check out the plot by calling 800-8-NYART. We're back. Bob and Yurt Live. All right. 1-800-836-9278. Now, to finish this up here, so Wesley Clark, he continued his testimony before Congress. Now, remember, in debating the other Democratic candidates, he says, "I've been against this war from the beginning. I've been very consistent. I've been against this war." What does he say? "I was against it in the summer. I was against it in the fall. I was against it in the winter. And I was against it in the spring. And I'm a ding-a-ling." No, he didn't say that. He said, "And I'm against it now." Well, after Baghdad fell, he writes an editorial in the London Times, which could be used as a campaign ad for George W. Bush. Because he says that George W. Bush should be proud of his resolve in the face of so much doubt. And the joyous throng swarming the streets of Baghdad bring to memory the fall of the Berlin Wall and the defeat of Milosevic in Belgrade. Statues of Saddam are smashed and defiled. So he's praising Bush for crushing Saddam Hussein's army and government regime. And then as Congress is getting ready to vote on a resolution to empower the president to go to war against Iraq, he testifies 2 weeks before. And he says, "Hey, every president deploys forces, and you don't need the support of other countries. You can do so without multilateral support. And if the United Nations doesn't give its approval, so what? They didn't give me approval when we went into to take out Milosevic. So you don't need other countries. You don't need the United Nations. The president could use force and do it alone." He continued in his testimony, "There's no question that Saddam Hussein is a threat. Yes, he has chemical and biological weapons. He had those for a long time. But the United States right now is on a very much different defensive posture than we were before September 11th of 2001. Saddam is, as far as we know, actively pursuing nuclear capabilities, though he doesn't have nuclear warheads. If he were to acquire nuclear weapons, I think our friends in the region would face greatly increased risks, as would we. And I want to underscore that I think the United States should not categorize this action as preemptive. Preemptive doctrine has nothing whatsoever to do with this problem. This is a problem that's longstanding. It's been a decade in the making. It needs to be dealt with, and the clock is ticking on this." That's one of the Democrats who says, I've been against the war from the moment they commenced it. I've been against it. I was against it in the summer. I was against it in the fall. I was against it in the winter. And I was against it in the spring. And don't you forget, put the ball in the pocket. Never mind picking any dandelions. Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught with the cistern empty on a Saturday night. It's trouble, my friends. I mean, that's what you get from the Democrats. A lot of fast talk. It's like Professor Harold Hill. Now, the younger people in the audience have no idea what I'm talking about. But that's all right. It was before their time. But so Clark explained, even though we may not have the evidence, this is interesting, and it's true, but we do have the evidence. But even though we may not have the evidence of a link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, he says it's evident that there have been contacts. Iraq and Al-Qaeda will exchange information. They're going to explore opportunities to cooperate. That's inevitable. And I think it's clear that regardless of whether or not such evidence is produced, that these connections between Iraq and Saddam Hussein are a threat. So he's one of the Democrats who are against it from the moment we commenced it. So if Bill Clinton had attacked Saddam, right? Bill Clinton. Now, Clinton attacked Kosovo in Europe, and all the Democrats took a fit, right? And they all screamed bloody murder because the United Nations was opposed to it. No, Clinton did it. They didn't care if he was bombing people to cover up a sex scandal with Monica Lewinsky. If Clinton did it, okay. So if Clinton would have done this, the same people condemning it, for the most part, 90% of them would have defended it. And I like to think that a significant percent of conservatives and conservative Christians would have approved of it, even if Clinton had done it. Even though we so despise Bill Clinton personally, I like to think that we would have approved of him using the military to attack our enemies when it would be justified, as in a case like this. All right, so that's it. That's our little experiment, a lab experiment in democracy, because you think the average person knows or cares about Wesley Clark being a hypocrite on this? Say the average Democratic primary voter, do you think they care? The only reason they may care is if they thought that if they heard this, that if it could hurt them beat Bush, that's why they might care. But in and of itself, they don't care. They don't care. Howard Dean is their anti-war candidate, right? And Howard Dean, back when we were going into Kosovo without the United Nations approval, said we don't need the United Nations approval and we can do this unilaterally if we had to. That's Howard Dean, the anti-war guy. Is he really anti-war, or is he just are his positions based on his lust for power? And isn't that true of so many politicians? Even the better politicians. Right? Because your desire to lord it over your neighbor, that's what politics in a democracy. In a democracy, politics is the effort to lord it over your neighbor. And that's one of the most base of human desires. It's not good to want to lord it over your neighbor. It's not a good idea. And those of you who've listened to the show for any time, you know that I'm not a fan of democracy. You know, I believe that the government has only two just functions that we could find in the Bible, and that they are criminal justice and infrastructure. Infrastructure like airwaves and waterways, for example, and that the government has the power to manage public resources that have to be shared, like airwaves and waterways, for example, and criminal justice. So pursuing criminals, trying them, and punishing them and dealing with lawsuits and disputes between people about who cheated who. That's the two functions of government, criminal justice and infrastructure, and the military falls under criminal justice. When you have a criminal country or government, then the military is used. All right, so those are the only two just functions of government, I believe, based on the Bible. You go through the Bible and you glean what you can about the principles of governance that God put in the Bible, and you don't see that the government has all these other functions, like health care. Should the government take care of our health? Should it provide us with diapers? Maybe it should clean our diapers? No, that's not the function of government. That's the function of families. And whenever the government begins to do what the family should do, then the families do less of it. So if the government's going to take care of people's, let's say, kiddies' nutrition, because some kids don't eat well. Well, if the government begins to feed kids, what will parents do? Now, think hard. Public school teachers, think hard. This is complicated. If the government begins to feed kids, what will parents do? Feed them less. Now, you might not be able to come to that conclusion if you're stupid. And if you're stupid, you'd probably tend toward being a liberal. But when the government takes over the responsibility of individuals and families, individuals and families begin to relegate that area of responsibility to the government. It's unavoidable. Like if the government said, we know people are busy, so from now on, you have a right to get an oil change. So we will change your oil. So once every 3,000 miles, you just have to bring your car in and they'll do it and they pay for it. Because after all, isn't it a right to be able to get around town? Everybody has a right to get around town. So oil change, right. But then you know what? Some people forget when 3,000 miles are up. They forget. And the government can't let you go through that kind of stress. So they'll check your odometer every couple weeks and make sure to get your oil change done. And so if the government did that, would people take better care of their cars or worse care of their cars? Worse care. So if the government starts taking care of kiddies, will parents take better care of their kids or worse care? Worse care. And so they said, well, kids are not getting a good breakfast when they come to school, so we're going to have a school breakfast. That was a great idea for about 4 years. And then they said, well, you know what? They get hungry about 5 hours later, and their parents are not giving them good lunches. So we need a school lunch program to pay for the kids to have lunch. And some schools, they want to give dinner, too. So, and why not, of course, diapers and babysitting service for some parents? And the more you do, the more the government takes over the responsibility of the parents, the more parents will relinquish responsibility to the government. And that's why God in the Bible constrains government to only these two just functions of criminal justice and infrastructure. That's it. Roads, harbors, airwaves. Like if, you know, Channel 2 is broadcasting on a certain frequency, and you can't be up in your attic building an antenna so you wipe out somebody else's signal and come in with your own. There's some kind of you take chaos and you bring order to it on those resources that have to be shared and managed centrally. But is democracy the best way to do that? Let's think about that. All right, so the overview of the Bible, I think most Christians would agree. What Christians could disagree? That the overview of the Bible is one of the best ways to seriously study Scripture. First, you start with an overview, and then you dig down into the details. If Christians stop to think about it, How many would say the best way is to start wrestling with the details? How many would say that? Any? Less than 1%, right? The liberal Christians. But what do we actually do as Christians? When you become a Christian, you go to Sunday school, do you start with an overview of the whole Bible, with how the story fits together, or do you plow into some detail? Hey, this is Bob Inyart with a live commercial break, and we're talking about the best way to study the Bible. What is the best way, comparing these two methods? Is it better to start out getting a solid overview of the Bible, the flow of the story, and then to proceed into the details? First get the plot of the Bible and then work on the details? Or is it better to become an expert on the details while the whole plot is still confusing? So let's say you become a Christian, you join the church, you go to Sunday school, you take some classes, you read a book on what? On, say, whether or not we should speak in tongues. That's popular. Or whether or not you have to be baptized to be saved. Or whether or not you could lose your salvation. Or how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Or how many pins could be stuck into the head of one angel. Whatever. Some details. And Christians, millions of Christians, mostly in America and around the world some, have become experts, they think, they hope, in some details, with really the whole overview story of the Bible being rather foggy. And so with the Plot Manuscript, our best-selling unpublished manuscript, we offer an overview of the Bible, real solid overview, and then the details begin to clear up for themselves. So check it out and read the plot. All right, here we are talking about, well, the two just functions of government, criminal justice and infrastructure. That's it. What else should the government do? Should the government educate us? No, that's not the job of the government. God instituted family, church, and government. And they each have their own spheres, their roles. And they should not usurp the responsibilities of the other branches or the other institutions. They shouldn't do that. And so let's see here. Government, family, and church. Okay. Now, democracy in our country, we've got democracy in action and New Hampshire right now with the seven dwarfs, or how many of them are the Jacksonless Five. I don't know how many Democrats are still standing, and they all want to lord it over their neighbors because they want to be the leaders of the nation so that they're propelling themselves forward, which I think is one of the base desires of human beings. So let's think about democracy generally. Theoretically, democracy is what? The rule of the majority. Democracy is the majority rules. So I want to suggest to you that the notion of democracy and of republics are destructive notions. A democracy, the majority rules? Well, government should protect the minorities from the majorities. That's what a government should do. A major The function of government is to protect the minority from the majority. Like if the majority is white and they want to enslave blacks, then the government should protect the minority from the majority. If the majority are Gentiles and they want to kill Jews, the government should protect the minority from the majority. If the majority are middle class and they want to tax their wealthy neighbors to take their money, to provide for health care and whatever, subsidize housing, whatever they want, food, whatever, insurance, then the middle class is the majority, and the wealthier, they're the minority, and the majority does not have the right to steal money from the minority. So the government, one of its primary functions is to protect the minority from the majority. Could that be disputed by anyone? How can that be disputed? So that if governments should protect minorities from majority rule, that's what should happen. If the majority votes for Hitler, like in Nazi Germany, actually, Hitler got a plurality of the vote, the same as Bill Clinton. He got about the same percentage of the vote that Clinton got with it when it was, who was it? Clinton and Bush Sr. and Ross Perot. And Adolf Hitler got about the same percentage of the vote in Germany nationwide as Clinton got here. So the majority rule is what the government should be designed to protect the minority against. So when the government is majority rule, then it's not very well designed to protect the minority from majority rule. And people say, oh, well, we have a constitution. Yeah, but the majority can amend the constitution, right? Yeah, the majority can amend the constitution. So majority rule is especially risky to the minority if the minority is, let's say, conservative born-again Christians. And so the majority of the culture doesn't like us saying that homosexuality is perverse and has been criminal for 3,500 years and should still be criminal. The majority doesn't like that, and they'll fire you. You'll get fired from your job at the phone company if you say that homosexuality is a perversion. While the homosexual who brags about his perversion will be promoted. And so you've become a minority, and you have been deceived into thinking that majority rule is a good thing. You know, Jesus Christ, the majority shouted, "Crucify him, crucify him." The minority was Pilate. He was a wicked king. And even as a wicked king, he said, you know, I don't find any fault in this guy. I can't convict him. I'll let the majority rule. And the majority shouted, "Crucify him, crucify him." It was the jury. It was a jury decision. Well, it's more likely that the majority will exploit a minority than that a minority will misuse the majority. Generally, it's more likely that the majority will hurt the minority. And democracy empowers the majority to abuse any minority that it wants to. Rich people, white males, conservative Christians, whoever. Pick your minority. And the majority, democracy empowers the majority to abuse that minority. Democracy is mob rule slightly slowed. That's what it is. 51% of the people have no inherent right to compel the 49%. What right do they have? And we have done in Sunday school, we've taken little kids and done a little experiment. Give each kid three Oreo cookies, and kids like Oreo cookies. And in this one class, there are about 11 boys and 9 girls. And we said, before you eat the cookies, make believe you're a government, you're a democracy, and you could vote on what happens to the cookies. So you could try to vote for everyone to give you all the cookies, but it probably won't happen. But you boys, you could vote that all the girls have to give all their cookies to the boys. So one of the boys proposed that, and they took a vote, and the vote was 11-9. And the boys won, and the girls had to give all their cookies to the boys. And we said, that's democracy. Is that right? Is it just? Because you have two more, does that mean you have the right to tell the minority how they can or cannot spend their money, or that you're going to take their money from them? If there's a wealthy guy down the street and he has 100 head of cattle and you sneak in at night and you steal 90 head, you're a cattle rustler. You're a criminal. But if you organize your caucus and you vote that he has to give 90 head of cattle and you sell it and you split the money up amongst the rest of yourselves, what? Then you're a what? Oh, a Republican or a Democrat. It's still stealing either way. If you use a bureaucratic method to steal, you're still a thief. With a democracy, the very word politics has become a pejorative. It's a negative word. It's an insult. Politician. Politician is an insult. Even to leading politicians. They use the terms politics and politician as insults. In fact, I have an example. Bill Clinton was on CNN with Larry King, and he was mad at George Stephanopoulos, his former aide. George Stephanopoulos, or Just Stop Annoying Us, or George Step on All of Us, whatever his name is. And he said that George Step on All of Us, he called him a Washington politician, and he said it like that it was an insult. It is an insult. Under a democracy, in a democracy, the very concept of politics is a pejorative. It's people struggling to lord it over one another. And have you ever heard the idea that committees are less reliable than individuals that have responsibility? Have you ever heard that idea? Like, if you need a job done, it's crucial, you're going to give it to a committee or to a competent person? Don't give it to a committee, please. Save yourself grief. Right? The church that's stuck, that it can't do anything. It's got, somebody says, hey, you know what? I'll paint this room. It looks terrible. I'll come in this weekend and paint it for you. Well, we have to take it up with the committee. Oh, you got to take it up with the committee. So they take it up with the finance committee, and they say, no, that has to be taken up with the administrative committee. The administrative committee says, well, actually, if we're going to pay for the paint, it has to go to the treasury committee. And the treasury committee gave it to the... So the large, and figure, think this through. The larger the committee, the more unreliable its performance. So if you have a committee of three people or five people, maybe you could get a lot done. Put 35 people on a committee, or 135 people. You think it gets better? Well, now put 100 million people in the committee, call it democracy, and let them steer the government. The bigger the committee, the more irresponsible its output. Democracy leads poorly. The masses, they hear sound bites. That's it, via democracy. And a soundbite democracy aids in the disingenuous, in politicians who flatter the people, like Howard Bean says, I believe, I'll tell you what I believe in you. I believe in you, except those lousy people in Iowa who voted against me. But other than them, I believe in you, if you vote for me. So that flattering the people is a symptom of what's wrong with democracy. When Jesus tells us the majority are evil. And you even hear President George W. Bush, you'd think that the American people should be made into saints for how righteous they are. All right, so when you want to figure out, well, how do you respond when people say the Bible contradicts itself? How do you respond? Like when the Bible says that if you want to be righteous, you have to keep the law. And then it says that the strength of sin is the law. Speaking of the same law. When the Bible says that circumcision is a perpetual covenant between God and his people. And then the Bible says that if you circumcise, you will be cursed and Christ will profit you nothing. Well, what is it, a perpetual covenant or is it a curse? Which is it? When the Bible says that mankind should eat herbs and vegetables and fruits, and God made man into vegetarians, and then God said, you can eat all animals, all flesh. And then God said, you can only eat certain animals. And then God said, you can eat all animals. What's going on? Somebody get the menu straight. What's happening? Well, what's happening is the Bible tells a story. And most Christians have never really thought through. They didn't even really think or realize that first God prohibited the death penalty and then he mandated it. Well, why did he do that? Why? Well, you can't possibly know why God did it until you know that he did it. That's first. And in the story, when you focus on the story of the Bible and try to exercise self-control about the theology and the doctrines, because we're all so uptight about our denominational idiosyncrasies, when you first look at the story, you see, wow, first God prohibited the death penalty, then he mandated it. First he required circumcision, then he prohibited it. And then once you see the story, then the why begins to become clear. That's what we do in the Plot Manuscript, by the way. We help people see the overview, the story of the Bible, and then the details begin to explain themselves. All right, so democracy. That's when your precinct gets together and the majority rule votes, right? Well, would you let your precinct decide your medical treatment? What do you think? Well, if no, should they decide the nation's future? You wouldn't even trust them to decide whether you need an operation or physical therapy or a new drug. You wouldn't let them decide that. And you're going to let your precinct pick the future direction of the nation? What, are they going to lay out economic policy? How do they know about economic policy? They're just like you, and you don't know about economic policy. How are they going to do it? How are they going to figure out the best foreign policy? How are they going to figure out who's just giving sound bites and lying through his teeth? They're busy. They have a life, a job, bills to pay, kids. They got kids to walk and the dogs to feed kids to feed and dogs to walk. They're busy. And so your precinct is going to decide these major issues for the future of our nation. Policies like monetary policy, criminal justice, foreign policy, these are way too important to be directed by amateurs who are working on cliches and sound bites. Morally speaking, the majority sinks to the level permitted by the government. Have you ever thought that through? Morally, the majority sinks to the level permitted by the government. So that if the government permits prostitution, then prostitution becomes a cultural norm. If the government permits the killing of unborn children, then abortion becomes a cultural norm. And we've got now over 40 million babies who've been killed in America. If government permits, on and on and on. So that morally, the majority sinks to the level permitted by the government. So what if now the majority rules? If the majority is the government, then nothing can stop a nation's decline. You know, democracy, think about democracy, where the people give authority to the governing officials. Well, that's backwards. Authority flows downhill, like water. Authority flows downhill, not uphill. So democracy is unnatural, and it promotes rebellion and egocentrism, that, well, everyone should do what I think they should do. So you've got 100 million monarchs, 100 million kings, 100 million tyrants. Like Mel Gibson said in his movie, The Patriot, he said, better to live under one tyrant than 1,000. Be they my neighbors. And that's true. You've got everybody from the cook to the plumber to the teacher who believes that everyone should obey the laws as that person deems appropriate. And gets angry that the government doesn't obey their beck and call and comply with their whims. That's That's the mindset that democracy creates. It promotes self-centeredness and egocentrism. You know, children do not vote to give their parents authority over them. Kids don't do that. Authority flows downhill. All authority flows from God down to the smallest child. So authority flows downhill from God through the government to parents to the kids. And even the kid could kick the cat off the couch, right? Yeah, authority flows downhill, not uphill. In democracy, authority flows uphill. So it's unnatural. And it promotes rebellion. Children don't vote to give their leaders, their parents, authority over them. And neither should citizens be able to vote to give their leaders authority over them. That's backwards. A democracy is destructive in virtually every way you look at it. Think of the fortunes that are wasted through elections. Not only on the money spent on campaign advertisements, that's the least of it. How about from the lost productivity of hundreds of thousands of people or more being actively involved in campaigns? All the campaign expenses, and then all the legal bribery, like when George Bush outdoes Bill Clinton, who would travel around the country and every group he'd meet with, telling them how he's going to spend millions or tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to give them, fulfill their special interest. And George Bush has outdone Bill Clinton with hundreds of millions of dollars going to groups that he hopes will vote for him. That's part of the cost of democracy. Legal bribery, it has become. You know, in the 1900s, democracy empowered the Nazis. And the Nazis and democratic socialists slaughtered tens of millions of people. That's what happened. In a war, let's say you're in a war and leaders are emboldened by a popular vote. And so they're going to carry out the majority will. And if they have to sacrifice another 100,000 lives, they don't care because those lives are not on their conscience. It's the will of the people. And the will of the people has no conscience. It has no reputation. Cicero, who lived before Christ, the century before Christ, he said, elected officials gain favor with the people by giving them other men's property. That was in the century before Christ. And Seneca, in the century, he was after Christ. Is that right, Seneca? I got to recall that. He wrote that democracy is more cruel than wars or tyrants. And these guys were right. Not that I quote them as my authorities, but just that they're making observations that are consistent with biblical principles, that the majority is evil. So why should the government be fundamentally majority rules? The detestable desire to lord it over your neighbor incites the worst of men to campaign for office. And democracy itself is a left-wing idea loved by liberals. And it appeals to those who are obsessed with control. I realize that that might seem like a paradox. But if you're obsessed with control, you make the masses think that they're in control, and then you manipulate them. And then you have true control. Because the bigger the committee becomes, the fewer are those who control it. Democracy is generally a facade anyway. Democracy enables a few to manipulate the many, and it easily conceals the true rulers. You know, the ones who decided early on that Bill Clinton should be president, so that when he's a minor candidate in this little state of Arkansas, what is he running for state attorney general? He gets He gets campaign donations from Chinese businessmen from out of the country, funds from, and, you know, he's chosen to be a Rhodes Scholar, not a rogue scholar, a Rhodes Scholar. It's a pro-homo deal. But so anyway, yeah, democracy enables the few to manipulate the many, and it conceals the true power bases. Democracy is the most divisive form of government. It sets neighbor against neighbor. So it's better to live under one tyrant than a million, even if you count yourself among them. History teaches, through man's inhumanity toward man, that men are not basically good, but inherently evil. So via democracy, the morality of the average man, it pulls government downward because the average man is wicked. If let's say you're a betting man, you're going to bet against the house, the casino. If you bet once against the house, you might win. And in the same vein, one leader might be benevolent, but not millions. If you have millions of bets against the casino, against the house, you're going to lose big. Right? It's just, it's mathematics. It's probability. Probability is ruthlessly accurate. And the same thing is true of the people. If you have one person who's the leader, he might be good. But if you have millions who are ruling, the majority, the decision of those millions will tend toward wickedness. And that's unavoidable. Because Jesus said the majority are evil. Right? So the majority is not good, as liberals contend, but evil. And therefore, the majority will steer a nation down the path of wickedness. Democracy will eventually decriminalize stealing, like with welfare and socialism. It'll decriminalize murder, like with abortion, euthanasia, suicide. It'll decriminalize adultery and all kinds of sexual immorality, homosexuality, pornography. Those are the things the majority will do. The majority approved of Bill Clinton. Why? Bill Clinton was a lying fornicator. And since the majority of Americans are lying fornicators, they felt good with him. He made them feel good. Because, hey, if he's a lying fornicator and he's good enough to be president, well, then I must be pretty good. So there are real problems with a democracy. And we ran out of time. I was going to take a few jabs at republics also. Because, you know, a representative republic is kissing cousin to democracy. The failings of democracy pretty much all apply to representative republics also. But anyway, we're out of time right now. So you could think that through. Are republics any better than democracies? Well, they're a little bit slower, but they're kissing cousins. It's the same thing in a democracy. You want to kill your unborn kid and legalize adultery? You vote directly for abortion and for sexual immorality. In a republic, if you want to kill your unborn children and legalize adultery, you vote for Hillary Clinton. And she does it indirectly. It's just a little bit slower, but it's the same dynamic. Hey, we're out of time. This is Bob Inyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.